Class is back in session. I'm getting an echo from somebody. I'm hearing myself as clearly as I'm speaking. Okay. Comments and questions before we move on. Well, as you may gather, if you can see the screen, our next session is our literature session, and we're discussing the short story Daffodil by Kenneth Morris. Kenneth Morris was a contemporary of Talbot Mundy. They became good friends. Both ended up as members of the Theosophical Society group in California, even though Mundy was born in England and Morris was born in Wales. Much of the teachings of the ancient wisdom ended up incorporated in the stories Morris wrote, as it did in the novels that Mundy wrote. Ursula Le Guin, the author of the Farther Shore and the Gedser, the Wizard of Earthsea, considered him one of the great prose stylists of fantasy writing, Kenneth Morris. While we're talking about Talbot Mundy, let me mention that we're publishing The Red Flame of Erin Pura by Talbot Mundy in just a few weeks. Those of you who have subscribed to the Talbot Mundy novels, we've got it automatically. This completes that series. This is the first time The Red Flame of Erin Pura has ever been published as a novel in the United States. It was published in serial form the magazine, slips my mind, Adventure, I think. But it was never published as a novel. So this is the first. It's a great story. But anyway, that's a digression because we're talking about Kenneth Morris. As I mentioned, he was born in Wales. The daffodil, if you research this, you would have discovered that the daffodil is the emblem of the Welsh people. It symbolizes rebirth, respect, and undying love. So, this is there. In talking about this story, what is the purpose? What is Morris's purpose in writing this story? And what does it mean to you? Anybody?
Well, it's a story of sacrifice.
Okay, Rose suggests a story of sacrifice. In what sense?
Well, all of the other knights that were there to hopefully get her hand had these wonderful, perfect resumes. And so the one who didn't have the best resume, as a matter of fact, it seemed like a horrible resume, that was where she felt she had something to offer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Other insights?
This was a beautifully crafted story. The thing that happened when I was reading it, it was so uplifting at the beginning. And then as the Lord and Spirit of Earth came in, it's amazing. I could feel the gap
already existing on the earth.
ends, when the princess came down and offered that symbol of beauty and hope, it was just a sense of uplift and knowing the promise of redemption of earth, and eventually it will be considered true. So this is a marvelous story.
Good. Anybody else?
Would you say it does describe transfiguration?
Does it describe transfiguration? Sure. Who else? Sure. Well, it was more than just a reminder. It was a living presence. And one could therefore make a, I think, a very profound analogy between this story of sacrifice, as Rosa said, and the crucifixion, that it's amazing to me. Every now and then I get a email from Newsmax, I don't know why, but every now and then, I get them three or four times a day, actually, but every now and then they list an article that they've published. Will he ever return? Sounds like the Kingston Trio.
Yes.
Will he ever return? No, he'll never return.
But they're referring, of course, to the return of the Christ. Will the Christ ever return? And I'm thinking, how dumb can you be? What are they missing? He's never left. This is the, if you were to give me a list of 100 stupid statements, this would be the most stupid statement I've ever heard. The question, is he ever going to return? Open your eyes, for Pete's sake. He's with us always.
Never left.
Never left. Never went anywhere. What is this nonsense? I mean, how barbaric is your level of thinking? How unsophisticated is your comprehension of life if you ask the question, will he ever return? And this is a news outlet that promotes this idea at least once a week. So there's this huge correspondence between allegory between the story of Daffodil and the story of the crucifixion. Go ahead, other comments and inputs here.
Carl?
Yes.
I was thinking in terms of Donna's comment earlier that it's a reflection of I'm not alone, that there is support and help and hope and so on.
Right. And no matter how, I mean, I love the characterization of Earth. Again, this is reminiscent of the fact that in Paradise Lost, the most interesting character is Satan, not God or the Christ. And Earth is certainly the only interesting character here, but as much as it's a way of symbolically portraying the fact that the Earth is not a sacred planet, as D.K. tells us, it's not a sacred planet, but we're here to help in the long process of in achieving sacred status. We don't know what that means, except that it's a state of purification and higher vibration, if you wish, than what we experience today. And this is a wonderful allegory of the mechanism for making the planet itself more sacred. It's not a story of human redemption. It's a story of planetary redemption. And it's not a story of sin. It's a story of elevation of awareness and consciousness.
Transfiguration.
Yeah, as Rose said, transfiguration. So, utter insights, other dimensions.
There's one other point that I love in the story is when Earth did break down, you know, and just said, I need you guys. I need you.
Right. And why did that impress you?
Well, it was because that was a turning point. It was, you know, up until that point, it was a facade and coming across as I can do whatever I want, you know. And then finally, the realization that, no, I can't, you know, not without you, not without realizing what I am, right? A part of
it. Okay. That his bravado and all the negative aspects of his character masked an inner awareness that he was very close to being a lost soul. Rose.
I guess I have to put it
sometime. No, go ahead.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
I sort of thought that he knew that this was all an act, that he was intending for it to be an act and a show to lack of a better expression, to show like, hey, I am a badass, you know? But he really knew very clearly that it was a show and it was not how he really was, but in fact he really knew that he needed help. He knew he wasn't this, like, you know, evil, super evil person, really.
Well, yes.
And I was a little curious about the other princes and their attitudes towards the spirit of Earth, that they were a little more sympathetic to his plight, that humanity has, you know, chosen this
role. In the story of the prodigal son, is the elder brother who stays home sympathetic to his younger brother who goes off and wastes his fortune?
No, he's not
very jealous. Yeah. Well, he's jealous. He tends to condemn and judge, pass judgment, and he doesn't have the understanding that his father has in his heart of the purpose of it all. Ultimately, this is a drama of seeing the larger scope. Rose, you had a comment.
Well, I was just pondering
hold that thought for a second, Bill.
On why the other knights, like Donna said, were not very sympathetic, or they just came out and said, hey, I can't do anything for you. You know, I send you my beautiful beams, and they come back in offense.
Right.
So were they saying that, indeed, they did try to help him, but all the help they gave was thrown back in their face, so there wasn't anything else they could do?
I think they were saying the move towards redemption has to start from within. Earth had to make his petition, his protest, his affirmation of the need for help. The great dynamic of Earth breaking down and saying, that's all a facade, I need help, mm-hmm. is confession. That's what confession is meant to do. We reach a point where we try it on our own, and then we realize that what has worked in the past doesn't work any longer, and we say, God, I need help. And only then can God find a way to do this. Yes, Bill? Well, it's more than that, because without experiencing death, Daffodil recognized, Lady Daffodil recognized that death was not a threat. She could have easily, when the earth said, you're going to die, and she confirmed this with Lord Martanda, she said, so be it. And she endured death, understanding that it was from generation to generation that she would multiply. The picture, the reason why I chose the picture of this field of daffodils rather than a single daffodil is that Lady Daffodil, the archetype, became, through the process of dying, millions of daffodils that filled the land and all the lands of Earth. And there's a tremendous secret there. Yes, Rose?
This also did remind me of, from Proverbs of Hell, the one, the road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom.
The road to excess leads to the palace of wisdom. Very good. Yes, I think Earth exhibits that. Other input here.
Still going with how humanity is represented also in Africa, even though humanity existed on Earth when she came down. I believe there's the power of the cross as well.
Sure. Well, of course. The spirit of Lady Daffodil has to incarnate in each one of us and go through this multiplication process for us to be transfigured and redeemed. It's our perception of beauty is what John Masefield would talk about in his wonderful sonnets about beauty. Beauty is one of the spiritual qualities or essences that humanity is most associated with and has the most experience interacting with. Hence, truth, beauty, beauty, truth, that's all you know on earth and all you need to know. And it's through, beauty refines our consciousness, and through the process of death, which is the ultimate key to understanding beauty, we synthesize what we've learned and we plant seeds in our next lifetime that multiply rapidly, seeds of opportunity and so on. How many of you have seen the final Harry Potter movie now?
I have.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I'm here with Lois. Yeah.
Dorothy has.
Good. I see a tremendous parallel here, because in the movie, of course, it ends with the apparent act of killing Harry by Voldemort. But all that was, and it becomes clear, all that was the death of the part of Voldemort that had anchored itself in Harry. That when Voldemort tried to kill Harry 18 years earlier, the intercession of Harry's mother to try to prevent that created a rebound of the death curse, and part of Voldemort's power went back and decimated Voldemort, but part of it, in the process of that, part of Voldemort went into Harry as a form of a Horcrux, and that he was the ultimate Horcrux. And that only by the death of the Horcrux in Harry could Voldemort be killed. So Harry misinterpreted this, of course, and stood there and let Voldemort basically do his deed, but he didn't kill Harry. He killed only the part of himself, the wands and the sword of Gryffindor and whatnot, protected Harry, plus his parents and Remus and all those people. They protected Harry and he didn't die. But Voldemort and his minion Sadi died, partly because Draco's mother said he was dead, and they all believed her, and they went triumphantly back into Hogwarts, carrying the limp Harry Potter, and announced, "Harry Potter's dead." And of course everybody, oh, they believed it. Gullible, gullible humanity. Even wizards can be gullible. And it certainly seemed to be proof. Hagrid was standing there, heartbroken, carrying the dead Harry. But Neville Longbottom, who of course emerges as the hero of Hogwarts, refuses to believe that. And he says, come on, let's not give up. Part of Harry lives on in each one of us. And only if we give up will Harry be truly dead. So through this ritual act of seeming to die, Harry multiplies and becomes the spirit in the hearts of everyone on the good side standing there. And Neville seizes the sword of Gryffindor that he had dropped earlier and slashes off the head of the snake, Nagini, which basically ends, is the death knell to Voldemort, although it's Harry that actually kills him. And that rouses Harry, who wakes up from his coma. Actually, he's been awake the whole time, just faking it. And there's a complete turnaround of snatching victory from defeat. And that's the act of transfiguration. That's the act of, we all have this horcrux within ourselves, and we have to do battle with it and defeat it. And then the Lady Daffodil within us can grow up and carry the day. So I think there's an enormous allegory there that it makes this story in some ways a key that very much enriches understanding Harry Potter and what's going on, and vice versa. Great literature always works that way, both ways.
And if they get the opportunity to see it in 3D.
Yeah, just a second. Rose was just saying, if you get the opportunity, watch it on an IMAX screen in 3D. It's worth it. It's we had the opportunity, along with Nancy, to see it in 3D IMAX, which really makes it look like that snake's coming right for you. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Mimi or somebody had a question. Oh. Well, everybody can hear you. Keep that in mind. Okay, so other comments and questions here about Daffodil. What are some of the... let me put it this way. To me, one of the great things about the story, and the same thing with Harry Potter, but since we're talking about Daffodil, the great thing about this story is it establishes, just by definition, the point that there are spiritual beings incarnating through the earth. The earth is alive and may be corrupted by materialism and appear brutish, but the spirit of the earth is self-conscious, knows that it's a spiritual being, and is striving to rescue itself from materialism. And it can only, materialism is the horcrux that lives within Harry.
So you're saying it's a laboratory for other?
Well, it's a laboratory for for lots of things, but the from what we know esoterically, Earth is a non-sacred planet that is striving to become a sacred planet.
Right.
That means a lot astrologically, and it doesn't matter which other planets are the sacred planets and which aren't. The Earth is in the process of redemption, and we're here to advance that purpose. So, and we do it through the tool of sacrifice. But what this is setting up is there is always a larger perspective to life. There's always a greater perspective. We, most human beings, tend to ignore that larger perspective and therefore suffer enormously as a result of materialism, doubt, ignorance, and so on. Disease, pestilence, whatever. But we don't have to suffer. If we understand that, like Lady Daffodil, we willingly incarnated to help the planet become a sacred planet. And it's well on its way. It's making great progress.
There is this phrase in here that just speaks volumes, just this one little phrase.
What page are you on?
105.
Page 105.
When she passed, a rumor of delight ran trembling after and before her. I mean, that just right. That just says so much.
Well, that whole, I mean, this is a great observation that I know, I've got it.
Okay.
It's, she is the essence of beauty and joy. In the gardens where gentian and larkspur and forget-me-nots bloom, when she passed, a rumor of delight ran trembling after and before. The little asterisms that nested in the trees broke into trillings and warblings of joy. Beautiful, 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 they sang. Delight, 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 delight. And we should, you know, that's a great point because we have the opportunity to constantly delight in nature and the earth itself. And to me, this story drives a stake in the heart of environmentalism. Yes, we should be stewards of earth, but the very first thing we should do is to recognize that Mother Earth is a tough old broad and is a spiritual being and knows how to balance the climate, knows how to balance nature, and we don't have nearly the arrogant power that we arrogantly presume to ourselves to mess things up. Yes, we have to be careful not to pollute, but we also have to be recognize that nature itself pollutes. A volcano spews forth far more pollutants than humanity can even dream of spewing forth. And nature is designed to process that. It's a wonderful system. And so whenever we contemplate nature, it should be with trillings and warblings of joy. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Delight, delight, delight. And to complain about it, or to conjure up fear and foreboding is despicable. It's blasphemous. And one can say, well, their intentions are good. Yeah, and the road to hell is paved with them. Other comments and input?
Whenever we
energy,
and it reminds me of the line and to do that to
Earth song. Right, the Robert Frost song about Eve. And you see, as you build up an awareness of these stories and poems and whatnot, you build up a mental structure in which a mental structure that's based on the ideas of sacrifice and redemption. and understanding that we each have a role to play in this, even as children, that as we learn to admire the beauty of daffodils, we can think of this story, and it enriches our experience. One of the things that I've found throughout my life is when I send out joy or light or blessings, there's always a response. Quite frequently an immediate response of, back at you, kiddo, in terms of the same thing. And an enrichment. We aren't just doing good, we're sowing seeds. And nature responds to that. Now, I'm talking about mental nature now. But we live in a multidimensional universe, physical, emotional, and mental. And we have a role as stewards to play. And all of this is brought up by the story here. Yes.
But I was thinking of all the words that I was thinking about. There's reflection of it. Yeah. I'm not only really old, but there is a crown on that flower. So I know the leaves, the petals, and even the petals. So it might be an essence.
Well, maybe we need to start in Wales. That would be probably difficult. But yes, other insights? This is a very short story, and yet it accomplishes a tremendous amount in very few words. In addition to everything we've talked about, it's also a poignant story that shatters the illusion of death. How many stories and novels did you read in school growing up that actually shatter the illusion of death? I'm not talking about how many stories did somebody die in, because most of the stories where people die don't shatter the illusion of death. They just perpetuate grief and nonsense.
Well, how effective do you think all the Harry Potter novels have been in doing that?
Well, I think Harry Potter has struck a blow in favor of the ongoing continuity of life, and that's useful. Anybody else about Daffodil? Yes. Well, a thought that just occurs to me, and this is a contribution from the Spooks, is that the word savage comes from the word sylvan, meaning of the woods. And, of course, it was originally applied to people who lived in the woods, were savages. There was no negative connotation. Another great word that has been destroyed. But it's the process of living in the woods that redeems savagery. Beauty redeems savagery. And nature redeems savagery. Anyway, getting back to the illusion of death, Daffodil asks, what means this die? Yet when she does die, she lives forever and multiplies. So we have to understand that allegorically, this means that consciousness can't perish. And actually, science has proven this fact beyond any reasonable doubt through its conversion principle of conversion. Energy can be converted into matter, and matter can be converted into energy, but it it never disappears. It just changes form, just as water solidifies into ice or aerates into gas. But consciousness is a continuum. Science has already proven this, just hasn't gotten around to articulating it very well. And coming to the logical conclusion that if energy never dies, it just changes shape, then the energy of human life never dies, it just changes shape. Now, my final question here is, if you had read this story in junior high school, how might it have altered your approach to living as an adult? Sure. Okay. Other comments?
I'm not sure I would see all that I see now in this story. And I don't think I would have a lot of fun.
Well, that's based on the school you went to. That's based on the schooling you had. Let me restate this. Yeah, probably not. I don't think I did. But even though I had a good school, it fell way short of the ideal. Let me rephrase my question. If you had read this story in a Walden Grove setting, which is the only way you would read this story anyway, because conventional educators have completely ignored Kenneth Morris and Talbot Mundy and others, if you had read this story in junior high or middle school in Walden Grove, how might it have altered your approach to adult living?
Well, I think you would become the hanged man a lot sooner.
You'd become the hanged man a lot sooner, Rose says. Well, that's probably true.
I mean, it would change your whole perspective on
it. Has that potential. It has that potential. And it gives you a basis of value and structure that is quite dramatic. You can read Aristotle, which we're going to talk about in a couple minutes again. You can read stuff in textbooks, but the beauty of fiction is it can present a story like this that stays with you. It's interesting in this context to think back on what you read in junior high and high school that has stayed with you and continues to inspire you today, even though you read it 50, 60 years ago.
Carl, I think the idea of Lady Daffodil sacrificing herself and then the beauty that follows from that, generations of daffodils, that might have been something that would have stayed with me.
Yeah.
And I would have pondered on that.
I think quite a few of us would have. And that would be a bridge to understanding that would have eliminated a substantial amount of grief and sorrow and confusion in our life. Because obviously everybody taking this class incarnated with a certain advantage, and that was that you were going to come this way and go through all these things. And yet there was no educational structure for us to attend that would give us these clues and tools early in our life. We had to go through a whole lot of building and revising and unlearning in order to get to the point where we could learn this stuff for a variety of reasons. But education should be designed to help those people who are ready to learn. And right now it's not. It's designed to indoctrinate to a socialized point of view, and it doesn't draw forth the creativity and spirit of the student. Any final comments on this before we move on? Anybody? I hear the bell. It must be time for the next session. I'm also hearing my echo still, so somebody's too close to their microphone and it's reverberating. Microphone is too close to the computer, I should say. Microphone too close to speakers produces echo. All right, this is our final session of the morning, and as was true on Monday, this is our session on thinking and the ethics of Aristotle. Aristotle next makes the case that the ultimate good is happiness. Now, he actually uses the word eudaimonia, and I rather suspect that in Greek, eudaimonia means something differently than our modern usage of the word happiness. But it was translated in my version as happiness. Did anybody have a different translation in their version that they read of eudaimonia? Well, all right. So by consensus, we interpret this as happiness. If one of you wants to look up the translation of eudaimonia, it's not going to be in the on the internet. Feel free to. It's spelled E-U-D-O-M-A-N-I-A, eudaimonia. But it's translated as happiness, which probably limits what Aristotle was saying tremendously. In our modern era, the Dalai Lama seems to agree with this assessment and has said that the end of all human life is happiness. The achievement, that's the highest state, is the achievement of happiness. So he took the safe and easy route of agreeing with Aristotle. Is this an adequate standard? Anybody? Is happiness an adequate standard for the ultimate good?
Well, I mean, it can't be sustained for one thing.
Okay. Why can't happiness be sustained?
Well, I could be happy one moment, and if you said some mean, cruel thing to me, I would be devastated.
I wouldn't say a mean, cruel thing to you, but you might interpret what I said.
Well, or yeah, if you say something and somebody misinterprets it, then, you know, happiness is out the window.
All right.
So there's no stability in happiness.
Right. We can therefore reject happiness as the adequate standard, even though eudaimonia might work. Other comments or questions about happiness as the ultimate standard of ultimate good? Well, I rather suspect eudaimonia means something a lot different. The word happiness derives in English from the syllable hap, which means event or occurrence. That's why you have a mishap. A mishap is a stroke of bad fortune, by our definition. Now, the problem Rose was getting at is that happiness is purely an emotional definition. If you enjoy what happens to you, you're happy. If you don't enjoy it, you're unhappy. So it's completely determined emotionally. But in its larger sense, happiness is nothing other than a life filled with events. If you take out the emotional component here, for the sake of discussion, the word happiness simply means chock full of events. I lead a happy life. I'm always busy. But of course, I, like Plato, see events only as containers for spiritual energy. An event is an event is an event until you transfigure it by approaching it with joy or harmony or truth or whatever. And so events are containers of spiritual energy which may be filled or empty depending upon our connection. A good symbol of this, it would be the cups in the tarot. The cup, each cup can hold a certain measure of happiness or spiritual good, but if we dump them all on the ground as in the five of cups, we may regret having done that. When a cup is emptied, its energy has been expressed through some event. It may be something we're proud of, it may be something we're ashamed of, but we've spilt our cup, either through investment or through foolishness. So the real dichotomy here is investment and folly. And we need the wisdom to see that investment is a good use of energy, folly is a dissipation of it. The events of life are therefore neither good nor bad, they just are. They are vessels waiting to be filled by us. And so think of Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane saying, praying to God to take away, if at all possible, this cup of bitter gall. The cup's just a vessel. But look, human being that he was, he owned up to the fact that he would rather have a cup of sweet nectar than a cup of bitter gall. But he was willing to drink the cup of bitter gall if that was in the works, which it was. And that that would fulfill the plan of God, which it did. So the events of life, as I just said, are neither good nor bad, they just are. It's what we do with them and how we view them that cast them to us as good or bad. So Aristotle has limited himself, maybe not intentionally, because I still don't know exactly what eudaimonia means since I'm not a Greek speaker. But he's probably limited himself, at least in English, by identifying the ultimate good of life as happiness. And because he's basing it then on events. Now he candidly talks about activities that lead to good and then activities that lead to bad. We have to discriminate between them. But this becomes a problem. So what do you think Aristotle meant by stating that the ultimate good is happiness? Anybody? What was Aristotle getting at, that the ultimate good is happiness?
Carl?
Yeah.
I looked up the etymology, and Wikipedia says that...
The etymology of what?
Eudaimonia.
Okay.
And according to Wikipedia, it derives from the word eu, meaning well, and daemon, sort of guardian spirit.
Okay. And mania means mania, probably.
Well, in other words, a well spirit, which then got translated to happiness.
Okay. Being the only English word limited scholars could come up with. I had not yet invented the term blisshap. But I have since, so we can talk about it in terms of blisshaps. That's good. I'm glad you did that. What that means is that, as Aristotle states, but again, it tends towards confusion in the translation, he makes it clear that this happiness must originate in the soul. Is what makes the soul happy or pleased. But then he, in later parts of the writing, he confuses the soul for the subconscious, because he talks about negative elements of the soul, which don't exist. So we have to be very careful picking our way through the landmine of this writing. But it's important because this is the basis of Western thought on the subjects of happiness and the ultimate good of life. But what he's saying, based on what Betty has discovered, is that the ultimate good of life is what pleases or fulfills the soul. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They studied Aristotle and Plato and all those cats. And so they knew what happiness meant. And keep in mind that the choice of the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness, or the inalienable right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, is not to say that happiness is an inalienable right, the pursuit of happiness is. And so each individual citizen has the right to determine what that happiness is. At the highest level is what pleases the soul. And so, you see, when I studied Aristotle, I was taught that Aristotle was rejecting Plato. It's clear from me that he was doing no such thing. He was building on Plato. He was perhaps emphasizing the active expression of Platonic virtues and ideals, but he was not negating them. He was not criticizing Plato's thought. And yet, that's the way it's been construed and taught for hundreds of years. So, the ultimate good is what pleases the soul. And what I was going to say about the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness is that that was an original coinage. The earlier version, a version which appeared in several early founding documents, was life, liberty, and wealth, and property, an inalienable right. This was the phrase John Locke used in his Essays on Freedom. The inalienable right of life, liberty, and property. And Jefferson deemed, and maybe the Congress itself deemed, property to be too limiting, too material. So they substituted the pursuit of happiness, which would include and embrace the concept of owning property. But we have an inalienable right to pursue happiness, to own the fruits of our labors, to not be taxed out of our minds, which is what's happening today. Okay, so getting back to Aristotle. Anyway, before I do, any further comments or input here? Well, Aristotle refines happiness to refer to the ability to express the virtues of the soul in a complete life. There is this sense of completeness in his definition. In other words, to fill the cup of human potential with the nectar of the gods, to put it poetically. To fill the cup of human potential with the nectar of the gods. The ideals of the gods, but this is definitely potential. It's clear that human life, as it's evolved to this stage, many people are incapable of achieving complete happiness, the ultimate good. Certainly incapable of achieving it in terms of what's best for everyone, which I think is the way we defined it on Monday. To start thinking in terms of what's best for everyone. And that, therefore, the ultimate virtue would be something like generosity. And that would, as opposed to being a tightwater, a skinflint. That generosity appeals to the soul, soul gives joy to the soul because we're sharing voluntarily the rewards that we've accrued for the good of the community, the good of society. Now we have to be careful to define generosity in terms that actually do lead to the good of humanity. I don't think that George Soros, for example, has a single bone of generosity in his system. He wants to, his money to feed the destruction of America. So we have to make that distinction. But what this means then in studying the ethics is the proper study of mankind would be the virtues of the soul. And hence that means that you might want to, over the weekend or next week, read Love Virtue as a complement to your further reading in Aristotle's Ethics. Ethics, then, in Aristotle's mind, becomes the art of shaping values that fill our life with these virtues and express them in all we do. And this is quite important because it can only happen through the use of the active mind and the active will. This is a voluntary activity. There are many, many people out there that have spent no time at all shaping their ethics. They may adopt an ethos from their ethnic heritage. They may adopt the point of view of the political party of their parents, but they haven't spent any time creating their own ethics. And until you do that and learn to shape your values on divine virtues, and express them in all that we do, they're theoretical, they're empty, they're meaningless. That's where hypocrisy arises. Hypocrisy is the ability to claim that you have a certain value and then do nothing to express it. In fact, you probably contradict it. Virtue demands us to establish ethics as a priority in making decisions about life and planning for the future and in treating others. Happiness comes as we learn to fill our self-expression with the genuine virtues of the soul, no matter how we ascertain them. And Aristotle refers in this context to the first principles of Plato. And states this is where you need to, as Plato recommended, to trace back your values to the virtues or first principles of divine life. So I'm going to go out on a limb and suggest that the better term than happiness in the English language for eudaimonia would be joy. It could be contentment if you understand it in my definition, because contentment would imply the filling of the vessels of life with what pleases the soul. But since we know that the definition of joy is the constant attitude of the soul toward life, an attitude of delight and pleasure, then joy probably is the most operative word to use. It is the byproduct of contentment, the ability to fill the cup of happenstance to the brim with virtue. So how does this apply to human living, daily human living in the 21st century? That's a question for you to answer here. Comments? Input?
Aristotle talks a lot about action. And out previous to that, I selected a tarot card at the bottom of the day, and I chose justice.
Ah.
So just person is able to tap divine guidance and translate it into powerful and compassion.
Right.
I think my question with choosing the tarot card was, okay, and Leo, you know, what is the quality or the archetype that I want to focus on? I got my answer right there. So I think for people today,
well, you see, that's a good dynamic example, because as I've so often said, the archetypal quality is not just this, it's justness, and or just, if you can follow that. Right. Right. So it's justness is the correct and proper way to do anything, and as determined by the soul. And so it's important, I think that's a great example, that we focus on the inner quality, not on our definition of the inner quality, and certainly not on the common human experience, which all but guarantees distortion. Okay? We're talking about how this definition of happiness, the ability to fill the cups of happenstance to the brim with virtue, how that applies to human living. And we're getting comments, insights. Anyone else? Anybody?
Carl, I guess a thought of taking things in stride, no matter what the happenstance is, it's all for the long-term better good.
Right. It's the virtue, to put this in an esoteric sense, just for the sake of time, virtue is of the level of the soul. Values are what we establish and then fill our character and behavior with. And so we've only completed the cycle when our comportment, our behavior, radiates the value based on the virtue. And only then can happiness occur. So it's important to understand that we derive the ethics from virtue. And then we interpret it as to how that our character should be changed so as to honor that. Again, hypocrisy, as I've often said, you can't be a hypocrite without value. You may betray the virtues of life, but unless you have taken the time to create values, your acts are acts of ignorance rather than hypocrisy. And so, to put it in a crude political way, and I apologize for crudeness, the vast majority of Democrats are never hypocritical because they have no values to begin with. Wu, who just was forced to resign, and couldn't see anything wrong with his behavior and had no shame and didn't want to resign until Pelosi leaned on him. Well, you can't accuse Wu of being hypocritical if he doesn't have the value to begin with. Or Anthony Weiner or anybody else. The likelihood is far greater that when a Republican is caught in such a peccadillo, he is a hypocrite because he has a value, at least he ascribes to family values, and runs on them, and then he's caught in violation of them. That's hypocrisy. But hypocrisy only occurs in that period of time between which you begin shaping values and trying to live by them and the time when you achieve perfection at that, and you always express the value that you have formed. But there's a period of hypocrisy is actually a rather productive part of life, of human life, because it exposes to us, it exposes the hypocrisy, for example, of a William Bennett, who talks about a moral compass and everything, and then has a obsession with gambling. All right. But only a person of values can be a hypocrite. To be honest about it all, the rest haven't risen to the level where hypocrisy is possible. And so you have to keep that in mind. If you never bothered to shape and cultivate values, you can't be a hypocrite. If you've never read Aristotle and tried to create ethics, you can't be a hypocrite. You do not know what you're doing. And that's the meaning of Christ's statement. Forgive them, Father, because they don't even qualify as hypocrites. Now, he was free in his condemnation of the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and called them hypocrites because they professed to have a devotion to God that they didn't have. So they were hypocrites. And he condemned them for it. And we should condemn hypocrisy wherever we find it, but with forgiveness in our heart, because very few of us are without hypocrisy, at least to a tiny degree. Other comments about this?
Okay. Rose. Are you asking how do we fill the cup?
Right.
Or
how does this apply to human life? How does the opportunity to fill the cups of events with the ultimate good of the soul work out in human living?
Well, so for people who meditate, we have the opportunity in our morning meditation to basically set the tone for the day.
Sure.
Try to attune to the plan of the soul for the day and see what of that you can glean.
Uh-huh.
And then try to express that as you go throughout the day. And so we would be filling the cup with the opportunity to express goodwill or whatever archetype, and those would be the things filling the cup.
Right. And more to the point, by doing that in your morning meditation, you magnetize the personality to attract opportunities to express goodwill, to express compassion, to express courage, to express whatever you're working with. And so this is where combining this with forces of the zodiac, where you learn what archetypal forces are at work creating opportunities and problems, on a day-to-day basis, you can make this a very intelligent tool for attracting to you consciously the very things that are going to happen anyway, but so that you can say, aha, this is my opportunity to be patient. This is my opportunity to be wise. This is my opportunity to be joyful and see it so that Aristotle is providing a structure for thinking here, which has evolved over the centuries and needs to be updated a little bit, but it still remains a powerful structure for thinking if you see that you can activate it.
Well, and then in thinking about filling that cup with the archetypes, a good symbol to help in terms of then radiating it out is the Titan's cup.
Right.
Because that cup is full to the brim, however, it is overflowing, and then there's humanity below it,
right,
you know, going about its day. So to always think about whatever energy you are trying to express, seeing that being distributed dynamically throughout your environment or sphere of influence.
That's good. Other comments and input here?
Yes, I was just thinking about this too. I was thinking of the idea of those hats. They're referring
in each of those taps, if you will, he asked me, what is his goal, what is his view, what is the highest given situation, and then following that guidance. But for, it's interesting that you have to have a virtue, you have to have a level of intelligence and understanding, even to skew the fact that there is a gap between what you might do and the highest, but you can't focus on the gap, you always have to focus on the highest. And I think that symbol that takes on your business that is always observed. That's a good way not to focus on the gap.
Okay, good. Other comments? Well, Aristotle adds the idea that it's not, but he uses the example of the Olympic Games, and he makes the point that it's not the winners of Olympic Games that we should praise, but the fact that they compete, that they participate. And so he redefines the ultimate good of the Olympics as not being a gold medal or even a silver or bronze, but the very fact that you are willing to compete and participate. And he says, those who act win, and rightly win, the noble and good things in life. They may not win first prize, they may not come in first, but by striving for the goal, they win. So that's an important point. It redefines the ultimate good. The ultimate good is not necessarily winning or coming out on top. It's what you learn along the way.
So they would have gotten gold medals in self-discipline, self-determination, dedication.
Right. Just in order to be able to be.
Yeah, just to be there.
Yeah. Okay. Any other input there?
Carl, I was thinking what our country's going through right now is trying to come up with a balance for our budget and feeling and all that. I think all this is, or I hate to say a couple of things, but there is a definite effort to try to come up to a solution. Are we fighting, where you said the Democrats, some of them anyway, may not be aware, but are we dealing with hypocrisy too? I mean, as far as...
Well, we're dealing with ignorance as much as anything. The idea that we can spend blithely without any restrictions is ignorance. And the idea that we have to cut our spending and live within our means is an awareness of reality and discipline and accountability. So this is a mammoth struggle between the, in terms of a definition of what the ultimate good for humanity, for America is. Is fiscal responsibility and accountability the ultimate good, or is blind spending and the incurrence of greater and greater debt that we leave to our children the ultimate good? And it's pretty obvious to anybody who's done any thinking that the latter is a recipe for collapse.
Well, and it almost seems like it's an embraced ignorance. They don't want to see, they don't want to let go.
Well, is there any evidence that they've ever done any thinking?
But on the positive side, as you just used the analogy of participating in the Olympics, I think the fact that this is being brought up, how many different approaches and bills or ideas can the other side bring up to say this would work, this would work, this would work. So that at least is a positive. We're participating in an active dynamic.
The overall struggle is a positive, but be careful. Don't give the other side too much credit because they haven't come up with plans. They simply said, we don't like your plan. They haven't made a proposal that has even gone so far as to be rated by the CBO.
But that's what makes me question, is it ignorance or is it
stubbornness.
Or hypocrisy, if they know better.
This is a classic example of the problems of letting an ideology govern your thinking. The ideology is that the government must provide all things for all people. The reality is that government goes broke trying to do that. Witness Greece, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, and many other socialist nations. Government goes broke doing that because it breaks the economy. It's far better to have a modest relationship between the a limited government that people can afford and then encourage them to find their own way to generosity and so on. But that's a long process of learning. And so we have people who have bought into an ideology and haven't gone through a conversion process like David Mamet has. So they're still saying, by ideology, right or wrong. And they blindly cruise forth to express that. Yes.
And yet we have these examples before us that we could be going to school on.
Absolutely.
And we're still denying, that can't happen to us. I mean, it's there before us.
Well, and so we should recognize that as the reality, but understand that this is a mammoth struggle at the level of the war of ideas. And it's a struggle that defines our generation. Now, Aristotle adds, no man is just who does not rejoice in good and noble acts, whether in others or himself. And we have to understand that means that if we recognize fiscal responsibility as a good and noble act, you can't be just unless you embrace that and rejoice in it. And the attempt to defeat that is an act of animosity. And he also suggests, yes.
No, I was just going to say, it's an invitation for many more people to be actively involved.
Sure.
Because if it's the government, it's passivity.
Yeah.
You're not active, you're not doing anything.
And notice how all these negotiations have been in private and then announced to the public. And that's a part of the problem here, too. The Republicans suggesting or crusading for fiscal responsibility have been very open. The Tea Party has been very open. The ones that want to defeat that have been very private. And let me finish this. We're running out of time here, but let me finish this. It is the expression of virtue that gives not only happiness, but immortality. The value of the act of virtue lives on in our character and in our talents. And Aristotle makes that point too. So the study of ethics begins with the study of virtue, and we will continue this discussion on Friday. Right now, it's time to wrap up the morning and to say we will reconvene at 2, but from 1:15 to 2, you work on your various projects that I assigned last time, the exploration of the laws. I think everybody pretty much has their assignments. If you didn't, let me know.